The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
The Institute of Art and Ideas, articles, videos, and podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, the podcast that brings you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. Are humans any good at making decisions? And are we motivated by reason? Or are humans evolved to make social and emotional decisions, relying on the value and importance of crowd responses? On today's episode, we're asking whether the best strategy for survival is emotion or reason. Joining us remotely to discuss rationality is Professor of Psychology and Behavioural Economics at Duke University, Dan Ariely, Professor of Psychology and Cognitive Science at Yale, Paul Bloom, and Director of the UCL Centre for Digital Public Health in Emergencies, Patty Koskova.
And you can ask the question, are we getting more stupid? How can it be that we die so frequently because of bad decision-making?
If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, and head over to our website, iai.tv. Back now to our host for this week's debate, Ganesh Taylor.
So, without any further ado, I'd like to proceed inviting you all to basically giving me your 3-minute pitches on the following subject, right? So, Paul, do we need to wise up and get more rational about our decisions?
Thank you. My friend Dan Ariely, as you said, writes bestsellers with the word irrationality in the title. And he makes the point over and over again that we're often bad at being rational. And I think he's exactly right. I think, in fact, at some level, he has to be right. We're animals, we're not angels, and our brains have evolved for a world very different from this one. And so when our Stone Age minds get confronted with a global pandemic affecting billions of people, we can do poorly. So as one example, we're really bad at risk assessment. We use a heuristic where the salience of an event is a cue to how probable it is. And so we radically overestimate odds of low frequency events like mass shootings and shark attacks, and radically underestimate the probability of highly frequent but more mundane events like heart attacks or strokes or deaths by alcohol. As another example, this is part of what I wrote my book about, our moral decisions are strongly biased by emotions, sometimes leading us astray. So there's all sorts of laboratory studies showing that we don't like to deal with trade-offs when it comes to being good, to helping others. And we actually distrust people who make such trade-offs. And this is a serious problem, particularly now, given that any intelligent approach to lockdown, school closures, quarantines, vaccination, has to involve a complex balance between cost and benefit. So if the question is, do we need to wise up and get more rational about our decision? The answer is absolutely. At the same time, I think we overstate how stupid we are. I think we're a lot more rational than we give ourselves credit for. And I'll make 3 quick points about this. First, 2020 has been an enormous success story for the paradigmatic example of human rationality, which is the practice of science. If there are still any skeptics in the world about whether science captures truths about objective reality, I'd be quite happy if you'd handed me over your vaccine when it's your turn to get it, because I personally am very low down the queue. Second, we have goals other than truth. So in the middle of the summer last year in the United States, there were large rallies for Donald Trump. And many people, including many epidemiologists, said these are going to cause many deaths due to infections, grossly irresponsible. 3 weeks later, there were much larger rallies for Black Lives Matter. And many of the same people, including many epidemiologists, were either silent about it or said, it's fine, don't worry about it. Now, this might look like irrationality, but it better reflects the fact that people have multiple goals. We have social and moral goals. Most of the experts, at least in the States, have liberal politics, and they thought the Black Lives Matter rallies were just, and the Trump rallies were not. And this is what dictated their response. Similarly, we shouldn't take people who reject these experts and necessarily say they're being stupid. Maybe they just recognize that these experts might have different priorities than their own. Finally, I agree, we're sometimes irrational, ruled by our hearts and not our heads. but we can also step back and deliberate over how well we're doing and try to get better at it. And this is a tremendously powerful form of rationality. And it's exactly what we're going to do now.
Okay, great. Thanks for that, Paul. I mean, yes, Patty, what do you think? Do we need to wise up and get more rational about our decisions? What are your thoughts?
Thank you so much. This is an exciting question because it is kind of worded in a way we should wise up and become more rational in order to live our lives more intelligently. And I think the question isn't posed correctly. I think we are rational and emotional animals. We are a mixture of humans determined by, obviously, our knowledge, what we know, our attitudes, and also the emotional and spiritual component of our beings is often neglected, but it is very important when key decisions are being made. And obviously, the most glaring example for someone in the, from the UK is the vote of Brexit. It was by no means a rational vote. It was entirely an emotional vote where people were projecting their ideas, their beliefs, their values, their satisfaction, dissatisfaction into, you know, on a paper, simple-looking question. But in reality, the complexity of it wasn't absolutely not rationally grasped. The rational evidence was absolutely clear what's going to happen post January 2021. It was an emotional decision. So how do we take it from there? I think we need to better understand what we as the humans are. How do we change our behavior, taking into consideration the cognitive component, the rational knowledge part of our beings, but also the attitudes and the emotions? And I will just give you an example from one of our research projects a few years ago. We developed a website informing public about antibiotic resistance. One of the major global problems we all should wise up about and do something about combating antimicrobial resistance. And this website was aimed at general public. And from the evaluations, we were assessing not just the behavior, what they would actually do when they when people get ill, just the knowledge and attitudes towards antibiotics. And in our research, we have discovered that only 25% of the people who improved their knowledge after using our website as an intervention actually changed their attitudes towards prescribing the right way. They would expect not to be prescribed antibiotics for basic coughs and colds, basically. So the right relationship between attitude and knowledge was only achieved in 25% of people. The rest of the people sometimes improve their knowledge and decrease their attitude towards prescribing the wrong way. They would expect even more prescriptions, even though they actually answered logical questions correctly after the intervention better than before the intervention. So it clearly illustrates how emotions and how attitudes are linked to our knowledge, but not directly, not linearly. And if you look at the standard behavior change theory using the COMBI, so bringing together our capabilities to do some decisions, which is skills or knowledge, our opportunity, we need to be given opportunity to actually do something, such as take a vaccination, but also the motivation. And I think the motivations in the COMBI is, I think, the most important to answer your questions. What are our motivations? What drives us and how we change the motivations of us as human beings or us as a society, sort of trying to steer the decisions towards more rational and decisions towards our personal well-being, but also our global good.
Interesting. Okay. Well, wow. Thanks for that intro, Patty, to your position as well. Dan, it's your turn to tell us whether or not we do need to wise up and get more rational about our decisions.
So we should, but it is a more complex picture. So first of all, as Patty and Paul mentioned, we have two sides to ourselves, and not every question should be addressed with the same decision apparatus. So Patty, I don't know you very well, but Paul I know for many years, and I love the guy. Now, that's an emotional thing. I see him and I smile. And we had an opportunity to talk. We haven't caught up for a while, just before this session. It was delightful, purely emotional, wonderful. We have things like love, like poetry, trust. We have all of these emotions, which are amazing, gift giving. We have these amazing activities that have nothing to do with rational thinking, right? Rational economists would say, don't give gifts, don't trust anybody. I mean, you know, all of this is not in the rational world. But the reality is that we also have to make decisions about other domains as well. We do, hopefully, will live for a long time. And we have to make decisions about retirement. And there are things like medicine and health. And if we don't make rational decisions in those, the failure could be very, very substantial. So there was an analysis in the US. Everybody who dies, there's an analysis of what were the causes of death. And they looked at how many people die because of bad decision making. So for example, if I drive drunk and I bang into a tree, I made a bad decision and I killed myself. Death to bad decision making. If I drive drunk and I kill somebody else, they did not die because of a bad decision. And they analyzed what is the percentage of death that is caused by bad decision making. And the amazing thing is that this number has increased dramatically over the years. It went up from about 10% when this data started being collected to about 43% a few years ago. And you can ask the question, are we getting more stupid? How can it be that we die so frequently because of bad decision making? And the answer is that we're not getting more stupid, but the world is becoming better at temptation. And if you think about people as having an emotional side and a rational side, we are not living in nature. We're living in a system with other forces around us. And those forces in the capitalistic system want something from us. So you walk down the street, but you walk down the street and every coffee shop wants your time, attention, your money right now. Every app wants something from you. You go into the supermarket with a plan, the supermarket also has a plan. And their plan is not the same as yours. And they control how the supermarket works. And they can do pamphlets about the importance of kale, or they can pump the smell of sugar and fresh baked goods. Which one is going to be better? So the reality is that we need to understand that we have to wise up. We have to wise up. We're making decisions that are killing us. I'm not just talking about corona, I'm talking about diabetes, obesity, texting while driving. And the question is, how can we do it? How can we do it? And I think the answer is not that everybody should just become better. You know, in the physical world, think about the physical world. Superman could fly, we couldn't, so we invented planes. Superman could run very fast, we couldn't, we have bicycles and cars. We have chairs, we have heaters, air conditionings, we have all of these things. We have an imperfected physical body, and we've created an augmented reality around it to support it. Okay. Clothes, chairs, airplanes. I think we need the same thing for the mind. In the same way that we don't tell people, please become cold resistant. We shouldn't tell people, please become rational. But we should build tools around us that allow us to get the good side of our brain to act and not to fail into the mistakes.
I'm struck by the fact that all three of you have completely agreed that we should be being more rational. And I just wanted to point out the fact that that's clearly a shared assumption that we're making, that it is the right direction to go. The sort of first theme of this debate was meant to be addressing the question, are we motivated by emotion or reason, and which one should we be motivated by? And obviously all touched on that, but Dan, I just thought, you'd sort of started discussing, the fact that you feel like we should be utilizing more reason, but perhaps you've indicated that we're actually motivated by emotion, though that might contradict with what you're saying in terms of, it's a rational process to want to do things that you can't do to some extent, maybe. I don't know. Go ahead.
So look, the reality is that our failures of lack of reason are just very big, right? If you think about what is the cost, if somebody is driving well 99% of the time and 1% of the time they're driving blind, or they're doing a selfie while driving, or that has dramatic consequences. So we live in a world in which we're more interconnected with each other. Of course, COVID is one example, but it's true for everything. So our mistakes can be colossal and can hurt lots of other people. So there are areas of life where we should explore. poetry, love, yeah, sometimes there's damage there too, but that's fine. But there are areas of life, like Corona deniers, that the consequences of actions are a little bit too big. And that's the place where we can't let emotions run wild.
Mm. So, I mean, Paul, you mentioned this actually in your opening thing, right? About, you know, the sort of discrepancy between people's views on congregations in terms of why they were happening, right? So, you know, what do you think should, you know, is which one of emotional reason should be a bigger motivator? And is it okay to, you know, flip-flop between them even, as you mentioned?
I actually don't see, it's an interesting way to put it, but I don't see reason as a motivator at all. I think reason is an instrument. You have a goal, reason tells you what's true, gives you the proper inferences. If I want to go outside for a walk, but it's raining, I don't want to get wet, reason tells me bring an umbrella. If I don't want to get COVID, reason says get a vaccine. But my desires come from my emotions. But emotions can be categorized in different ways. Suppose I want to be a good person. I want to help people. I don't want people to get sick, which I think we are good people in that way. That's a primary motivation. But then in order to make it happen, we sometimes have to be very careful about our feelings. So you point to, I wrote, my last book was called Against Empathy. And it's kind of a crazy title. Like, who could be against empathy? Empathy is caring and love and everything. But the case I make is, if you want to make things better, don't listen to your heart. Don't be drawn to help the people you want to help, because the people you want to help are going to be attractive. They're going to be your same race. They're going to be from your same community. You're going to help in ways that make the world worse sometimes. If you want to make the world a better place, if you want to satisfy your goals, your emotional goals, you sometimes have to be rational. You have to put aside your short-term gut feelings. And Dan points out that's very difficult to do sometimes. You can't become a better person. So often we should use technological fixes. Here's a simple example. Suppose we don't want people to be biased when choosing job candidates. We can just say to people, don't be biased, don't be racist, don't be sexist. It's a terrible way to do it. We're very bad at shutting down our biases. But you could do technologies like blind reviewing, or you know, auditions for people behind screens, where people's biases can't come into play. We could be smart enough to set things up to get what we want without having to be better people.
What happens though, you know, so we use this technology, the computer, you know, tells us this is the candidate, this is the person you've employed. And then the technology serves up something to a human being who you are saying is fundamentally unable to, you know, maintain that system all the time. So what happens then? You serve an unbiased outcome to somebody who can't actually handle their own biases. What then?
You have outcomes which are less racist, less sexist, more fair, that you're happy with. Everybody says, I don't want to hear from a computer. I want to listen to my heart, my gut feelings. But you don't have to be a social psychologist. See, your gut feelings, my gut feelings going to get me to hire a white guy. I'm going to pretend I can't. My gut feelings are going to say, oh, homosexuality, that grosses me out, so I'm against it. My gut feelings are going to say, vaccinations, I want mine right away. So offloading them to, it could be a computer, it could be other people who are more objective, is on balance a smart thing to do. And you're right, it sometimes doesn't feel right. People always say, let me follow my gut and make the decisions. But that brings you to all sorts of bad consequences.
Go on, Dan. I feel like you were ready to go.
You had this model in your mind in which the computer brings up a hypothesis, the person doesn't like it, and he rejects it. But the reality is that once the computer brings up a hypothesis and brings up a candidate, a lot of the barriers goes away. Because as Paul was saying, if you think about a hidden bias, that happens during the interview. So you remember the old research on Pygmalion effect. You have a group of kids in a classroom and you tell the teachers, these are geniuses, just amazing. And these kids, not so much. And then the teachers goes ahead and interacts with them. At the end of the semester, you find that these kids were indeed geniuses, these kids were not so much. And then you find out that this was random. But there was hidden biases, and the teacher said, oh, these are geniuses. Let's listen to them more. Let's nod to them more. Let's get them to participate more. So a lot of the biases are not outright racism. Like if I just hate people X and the computer serves it to me, that's going to be very tough. But if the process itself is biased in a way that I nod more to people who are like me, I feel more connection, I smile more, I put more people at ease, then we have a very, very flawed process. Now it's very hard to overcome it naturally, because if I feel closer to person A than person B, how can I not be a little warmer to person A than person B? So we need to devise those mechanisms. And for me, by the way, that's the hope. The real hope is, yes, it will be really nice to fix people. But, you know, we've evolved over a long time. Fixing us is a real struggle. A sooner, better thing to do is to create technologies that basically let our good side flourish and not let some of our problematic biases show up.
Interesting. And like Patty, why don't you step in? I'd like to hear about what.
Guys, I'm really impressed that you think technology will fix everything.
As a computer
scientist in me, I strongly disagree. We obviously can write programs and we can offload some decisions such as biases onto computers. But we can also write programs which would be biased in themselves. And one of the major challenges faced by machine learning and big data science these days is exactly, there is an embedded bias. If you're training an algorithm, the way you start training your training data set obviously will lead into your interventions and your outcomes. So there is an equally enough complex and not fully understood bias when it comes to computer-based decisions, especially in the machine learning and the big data world. And I would say...
By the way, Patty?
Yeah?
I think that Paul and I, and I hope I'm dragging Paul in this correctly, we are not in the black box machine learning algorithm camp for exactly those reasons. There's algorithms and algorithms, the whole world of algorithms. And we worry in the same way that an algorithm that is just training naturally might be trained to repeat our mistakes. The algorithms that we are trying to promote are algorithms that are very careful to think about which part of the human element we want to bypass and which one we want to live to humans. So it's not like, here's a black box thing, please take all my hiring decisions from the last 20 years, repeat that. That of course is not the right way. It has to be a much more nuanced detail analysis of where do we go wrong. And only if we agree that we go wrong somewhere, we try to fix that patch.
Mm-hmm. Does anything work talked about though? Like, have you been able to change people's motivations in any way by using technology or otherwise?
So I'll give you a most trivial example. I was trying to get people to lose weight. And as a social scientist, you say, how do you get people to lose weight? So weight loss needs to be every day. You can't try to lose weight 5 days a week and party 2 days. And it has to start in the morning. You can't start after lunch. So I looked at the bathroom scale. And what I learned is that our weight fluctuates a lot throughout time, depending on what we eat and when we went to the bathroom. And also, if you start a diet, it could take about 8 days to 2 weeks for the diet to show up, for the effect to show up. So people go on a diet for 3 days, they stand on the scale and say, nothing happened. What's going on? I had 3 days of only lettuce. Like, where, what's going on? So we change the scale to not have numbers. And instead, the scale is showing the trend of the last 3 weeks. It's generally going up, it's generally going down, nothing happened. And in a very large scale experiment, we show that our scale is much, much better. A scale that shows the number frightens people, confuses them, they stop scaling, standing on it. A scale that shows the trend, people understand the relationship between what they do and the outcomes, and they're much more motivated. In the regular scale, on the 6 months long trial, people gain 0.3% every month. In our scale, people lost 0.6. Now you can say, that's not a big technology. Yes, this is technology. How do we think about the number that would be intuitive for people to understand and keep them motivated?
I would have to say, yes, obviously I am not a computer scientist against the entire sort of technological achievements of not. So I think your question was thinking, do we actually know if technology can change our decisions, our motivations, and our behavior? And one other part of my research is using persuasive games, which is development of software in a sort of field of serious games, so games with some kind of purpose and meaning, to change people's behavior. So, one of my interesting programs was working with surgeons in Nigeria and made them change their decisions about antibiotic prescribing to increase compliance with WHO guidelines at the point of care. And the beauty of the technological intervention is it also collects the data about how people are actually changing the behavior seamlessly through interaction with the technology. So we could actually demonstrate, yes, this app has increased compliance in 3 different hospitals. So you can definitely develop technology which fulfills exactly the purpose you said. It makes you think about your decision not being quite correct, in this case not compliant, and gives you the opportunity to change it. But I wanted to say that I think we have focused too much on technology, as this was like the silver bullet. From a behavior perspective, there's a behavior wheel framework looking at what all components of our individual, societal, legal, and financial incentives need to be in place to change certain decision and attitude. So, for example, if you look at one of the most successful public health programs, which was smoking cessation, it took 20 years. It took 20 years to change legislation and make it not possible to advertise cigarettes to young people. It obviously has changed the way we are branding cigarettes, making it clear that they kill people. It also have gone into changing the way we are obviously socializing. Banning smoking in offices and in public spaces, in restaurants and pubs, was a major step 10 years ago. But now we have changed. Actually, I'm speaking for kind of Europe and I would say the Western world. We have changed the attitude so much that smoking is no longer cool. It's something where the behavior in a longitudinal trajectory has been changed. But all these components had to be together, not just the individual information for a smoker telling him he or she will die or develop lung cancer.
I think that that's great. I think in some way technology could do a lot, but for reasons you pointed out, there's all sorts of issues of it. The broader thing that I think we all agree on, but is really worth pursuing, is figuring out some way to take it away from, to make us more rational. And one way to make us more rational is offload some things onto technology or computers. Another way is to change practices, customs, laws. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, we're at science is our great success story of rationality. And it's because science is a very unnatural cultural institution that works in bizarre ways, often imperfectly. But somehow it lets us discover things about the world. There are customs, ways of deliberating. So people think of technology, they have computers and everything, but another human invention is you get 10 people together in a room, you say, we have to do a policy for the distribution of vaccines. How should we make a decision as a group? And then I think social sciences have an enormous amount to say. And a lot of what we end up doing are figuring out mechanisms to maximize rational deliberation and diminish short-term emotional desires. Thinking in terms of cost benefits is a great thing.
I'm going to jump in there because actually, so, you know, the point of this question was to sort of address whether or not we're motivated by emotional reason. You guys have all agreed on that. So, you know, the next theme was meant to be, is our attitude towards risk rational? And has it been throughout the pandemic? And as you've started touching on that subject anyway, I'd like you to finish sort of your thought train on that sort of trajectory. So, Are we rational about risk, and actually specifically in the context of the pandemic, how has that been in your opinion?
No, we're terrible about risk. We're terrible deliberators when it comes to risk. There's all sorts of things we're saying which are controversial, but this is not controversial. We radically overestimate the risk of low frequency events that are salient. And in fact, you know, one thing about COVID is if you're 25 years old and you get COVID, most likely nothing bad will happen to you. You will not die. The odds of you dying if you're 25 years old is strikingly low. But we hear salient cases, and all of a sudden people are terrified that a 25-year-old will die. And similarly, when a vaccine comes out and is in common use, no doubt some people are going to get sick and die. There's already been people harmed by the vaccines. They're low frequency events, but they could get blown out of proportion and lead to vaccine avoidance. So thinking rationally about risk is absolutely critical. And this is one thing we do poorly. We're just not built to think statistically in the right statistical terms about risk. Or to do trade-offs between, you know, the damage caused by a lockdown, which is, you know, non-trivial, and the damage caused by the virus is certainly not trivial. This is where we're at our weakest.
So, here's a question then. So let's assume that I'm assuming the other two on the panel agree with that. Is there anything that you think that, you know, governments could do to capitalize on that sort of inbuilt irrationality to increase the fear of COVID-19 and like reduce transmission? You know, I feel like the media, at least in the UK, you know, the posters I've been seeing have definitely gone from just very passive, you know, wash your hands stuff to be really trying to trigger a fear response, at least from what I've seen in central London. So yeah, Patty, for example, what do you think? Dan, what are your thoughts on that? Governments leveraging our irrationality for good or maybe not for good?
So first of all, we are in kind of starting year two of COVID. We're not in the beginning of year one, and we can't erase what has happened in the past. So for example, there's lots of history of lack of trust of different governments, and COVID is a public good action. If 20% of the people don't pay taxes, 20% of the people don't pay taxes, we have 20% less taxes. If 20% of the people don't adhere to social distancing, it's not 20% damage. They can damage lots of people, right? So COVID is about a public action. And, you know, we've been waiting for a vaccine, but the reality is, you know, it's amazing. We didn't find collectively, we didn't find the ability to slow down. Like, you know, there were still weddings and gatherings and people were, it's kind of amazing. But if you think about the damage that we have caused to ourselves in this regard. Now, thankfully at some point, you know, everybody will get vaccinated, hopefully, but until then, like, how couldn't we find the ability to delay gratification, right? Say, okay, just hold on for 2 months. Like, if we all held on for 2 months, think how good things would have been. But in terms of fear, you know, fear is a very good motivator, can't sustain for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the reason it can't sustain for a long time is the experience. So imagine I'm terrified of COVID. I'm terrified of COVID and I go to the supermarket and somebody doesn't have a mask and they cough and I'm really worried and I'm anxious, but I go home and nothing bad happened. It's a small probability event. Not everybody's cough will get me sick. Now my experience is that I'm less worried. So ironically, countries that have controlled it quite well in the beginning, they had an experience that I don't know anybody who got sick. Right? And if you think about how much do I learn from the newspaper and how much do I learn from my experience is usually the thing that people take more seriously. So people have their own experience and then they're less careful. And every time you do something where you're not careful and you don't get sick, you learn the wrong lesson. And that continues. So I think the fear is not a long-term strategy. You can't get people to be afraid for a year and consistently, right? You can get them to be afraid from time to time, but consistently fear is not effective. What you need to do, what we should have done, is get collective action. We have the capacity to care a lot about other people, but we have to see that everybody cares a lot about other people and we're not the only suckers who are sacrificing things for the collective action. I think that's what we should have worked on.
Interesting. Patty, you look like you're agreeing. Do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I absolutely agree, actually. You know, I think it's important to understand we are not making a decision about just ourselves when it comes to our response to the pandemics. We are making decisions as a member of a society. And even as you said, Paul, you know, the 25-year-old, a healthy teenager or 20-something could actually just behave recklessly because he might be at very, very low risk himself. He can infect someone who is vulnerable. So the responsibility for vulnerable, elderly, or other members of our society really need to be embedded in our values. And I agree with you, Dan, that we as a society should have much closer, much stronger, actually come together to underpin those social values, the community values, which are essential to implement any governmental measures. And I think the government in the UK has completely broken this rule. People have been trying so hard in the first lockdown to really not see their relatives. Stories of people who haven't seen their dying relatives because they have been compliant with the strict lockdown rules. And then we see Dominic Cumming driving, you know, famously to Barnard Castle for his wife's birthday. So suddenly the whole thing about why am I sacrificing myself when the privileged ones are breaking the rules suddenly was a game changer in the UK. And people became much more less compliant, and obviously they much less trusted the government since these information was coming out. So it's also kind of the attitude towards the trust, not just the rational decisions and the policy implementations governments could obviously have done better. Like the test and trace isn't working in the UK. So the self-isolation must be supported financially. If you can't afford to self-isolate, why would you get tested? You don't want to know that you are positive because you have to continue working. So the government has to put in all the components to make the collective action the central of our decision-making and values, but make it technically feasible for people to do so, but the government can't break the rules themselves.
I think there's just a lot of really good points here. And one point that I think has been emphasized by both of you is we're social creatures. It's not true. It's a terrible lie to say people are purely selfish. People will do a lot to help others. They'll do a lot to help their family and their friends and even strangers in their community. And if you tell the 25-year-old, you're safe, but you don't want to get other people infected. If you do this in the right way, we're social, we want to help. But this cuts both ways. And you're talking about the UK experience, which is if we feel others are cheating, and it's the same thing with regard to climate change. If we feel others are benefiting by breaking the rules and breaking the social contract, nobody wants to be a sucker. You know, if I have to cancel my wedding because of COVID, and I can't see my parents because of COVID, yet I see other people in power, having, you know, getting together and having parties and everything, I feel like a sucker, and nobody wants to feel like a sucker. And so trust is important. It can be a powerful motivator, but when it's shattered, it makes people act almost vindictively, sometimes even against their own interests.
I want to add one other thing. So, you know, we both, I think, don't take risks seriously enough and too seriously. So let's take a terrible case. Let's say COVID would kill 5% of the world population. And let's say it would happen quickly and people were not going to hospital beds. They would just die on the spot. So COVID would spread. People would die immediately. There would not be any challenges in hospitals. And then you ask the question of how much are we willing to pay to prevent that. Now, the reality is that in public health, we have numbers for how much it costs to save lives. In every country, for example, lots of people die from infections acquired in hospitals. And we know quite well how much money is needed to finish that problem, right? And it's not that much. And nevertheless, we don't seem to have the will to do that. Or imagine that an alien came to Earth 3 years ago, and the alien wondered, these earthlings, how much do they care about the elderly? How much are they helping them out? What are the allowances for old age? What are the benefits? How much do they visit them? You know, the alien would look at revealed preferences and say, you know, how much do these people care about the elderly? The alien would have concluded not that much as a society. All of a sudden comes COVID, and you say the alien that came now, say, how much are these people care about the elderly? You say, a ton. They're willing to mortgage their future. They're going on lockdowns. They're doing all kinds of things for that. And I think, you know, on one hand, I'm really, really sorry that we couldn't get our act together, but because this prolonged pain is, we're kind of getting the worst of both worlds. We could have had the shorter pain and gotten much better. So we're getting both the prolonged pain and the economic devastation. But I also think that we are, in many ways, have a very different set of preferences during COVID than we have for the lives of others in you know, just a short time ago or in other domains, like you mentioned, drinking and of course smoking and obesity and diabetes and all of these problems that we wouldn't have imagined spending 11% of the world's GDP on solving obesity, for example, or diabetes.
So actually, I want to jump in on that. So, there's some really interesting numbers about, you know, alcohol and tobacco consumption and how much it impacts the health of our society and how much we've, you know, already put into it. Patty raised the 20-year campaign to sort of, you know, get rid of smoking in public places. So, you know, the question is really, if our attitudes to risk were actually truly rational, surely wouldn't alcohol and tobacco consumption sort of disappear overnight if we did the maths?
As somebody with a whiskey bottle behind my right shoulder, I feel I should speak out on this. The alcohol and tobacco issues are complicated in a way that the COVID issue isn't. Nobody wants COVID. It's just, you know, there's no good to it. But alcohol and tobacco give us pleasure. And you know, nobody wants to be obese, but food gives us pleasure. So there's kind of a balance. And that's what makes these things unusually difficult. There are issues of the balance between pleasure and pain. There's issues of human freedom and so on. So I think in some way deaths due to alcohol and tobacco and so on are a difficult comparison to make to the COVID case for that reason.
Hmm. I think, Paul, you would agree that people would not overconsume if people were perfectly rational. You would say people would balance consumption and people would not become alcoholics, for example, or
nobody wants to become an alcoholic.
Yeah.
People may over, I was pushing back, you may want to overconsume during certain occasions, but yes. Nobody wants to become an alcoholic. Similarly, people love to enjoy good food. Nobody wants to be obese. So I agree with that. And nobody wants, and people might enjoy a cigar or a cigarette, but nobody wants lung cancer. So in the extremes, they are pure evils, but the fact is these bad things are caught up with good things. And in some way, it's of course, there's a complicated trade-off right now with COVID, which is the suffering due to lockdown. So, you know, every society I know has some sort of lockdown, but you have to balance it in some way so as not to cause unnecessary suffering.
Do we think that culture is going to become more emotional or more rational as we go forward? Do we think this pandemic's going to cause us to be more rational? You know, that's been the whole argument throughout this pandemic. Or do you think there might be a bit of a backlash and suddenly people think, you know what, this lockdown's really made me realize that all that matters is how I feel, really, more than anything else. So if you could just sort of start, telling me your thoughts on that. Do you think we're going to become more rational, more emotional? Patty, you haven't spoken in a little. What do you think?
Interesting question. I think we want to stay as we are as a humankind. We will remain rational and we will be emotional. The kind of mixture of the rational and emotion will be post-COVID world present as much as it was before COVID. I think the change we have observed in the last year, which is a positive change, is there was a regain of trust in science, in authorities, and in some cases, in politicians. You know, and you, Paul, said every society is in a lockdown. That's not true. New Zealand isn't. So New Zealand had a very good female leader, I must say so, who actually managed to get rid of it very, very quickly. And then the society is economically growing and people are enjoying their lives as normal. So not every society is in a lockdown. So I think the kind of trust in the right quality of leadership, and I think the New Zealand is a good example, and the increased trust in a scientific value, scientific voice, and experts, which have been a bit devalued in the last kind of post-truth political world, I think is a positive outcome of the pandemics. So I think in this way, we will become more rational because we again will trust the people who know more about the subject than we do. But I think we will still remain very emotional.
Mm. Paul?
It's tempting to say, oh, it's a bit of both, it's complicated. But I'm gonna be with Patty. I'm going to go for, we'll be more rational. In a broad span, I think we kind of, Western civilization has had quite a moment recently with Trump and Brexit and all sorts of things. And I see a kind of swing of the pendulum where we are going to trust experts more. There's going to be more respect for science and more respect for rational governorship. I mean, obviously, both parts of our nature will shine. But I would answer rational.
Okay. Dan, with the last minute.
So I worry, and the thing that worries me is that in almost every society, there have been fractions who are, by their behavior, costing tremendous amounts for everybody else. And I think this pain is not going to be quickly forgotten. So if you think about a country with a small group of people who are COVID deniers, who had a particular religious belief, ethnicity, political belief, and by this action, they are causing pain for everybody else, I think this will create more separation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's beautiful about human beings is that we care about other people. It's an emotional side. But the rational side is that we really need each other. We really need collective action. We have to work together in modern society. We can't have things and we don't work together. And I worry that this aspect of working together has been eroded. And it will take a really long time to fix.
Well, that's a very sobering note to end upon. But it falls to me to thank all three of you to sort of help us start negotiating this sort of difficult terrain between rationality and emotionality.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. Remember to like, subscribe, and review wherever you listen. And tune in next week for more big ideas from the world's leading thinkers.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.